Welcome, everybody, to Libertarian Ethics Lecture 6. I'm Daniel James Sanchez. You can call me Danny. And this is the final lecture for the course with myself and David Gordon on the ethics of Mises, Rothbard, and Hoppe. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. It's really great to compare and contrast the ideas of these titans, and I would include in those ranks Hazlitt himself as well. He did a lot to sort of fill in the gaps of Mises' theory. He wrote in a much more systematic way about ethics as a discipline than did Mises, even though he shared many of Mises' conclusions. And I hope that that I have done a good deal to systematize Mises's particular thoughts on ethics and his social theory in general. He's a very systematic thinker, but parts of his system are sometimes scattered across multiple treatises. So, without having read the whole corpus with kind of a synoptic view, it can be easy to miss that systematism, especially since Mises didn't write something analogous to Rothbard's Ethics of Liberty or Hoppe's Economics and Ethics of Private Property. With that being said, I'm going to go on to my first topic. Today I'd like to discuss Rothbard's critique of Mises, and I assigned this in the readings as an excerpt. Well, it's an excerpt from his treatise. Well, not, it's a kind of a after the fact treatise. It's a compilation of many of his writings called Economic Controversies that was recently published by the Mises Institute. It's a great collection of Rothbard's works. And one of the excerpts is the essay Praxeology, Value Judgments, and Public Policy. And it is in that paper where you find Rothbard's most systematic critique of Mises. And I'd like to go over some of the issues that Rothbard raised concerning Mises. And of course, coming from a Misesian point of view myself, I'm for the most part I'll be defending Mises and raising what I see as some misunderstandings on Rothbard's part concerning Mises. And I welcome Professor Gordon to please correct me in the chat regarding any mistakes I make or any misinterpretations on my part that I have regarding Rothbard. Now, at the beginning, he comes to the conclusion, Rothbard comes to the conclusion, he says, in the final analysis, either such a discipline, and he's referring to the discipline of objective ethics, exists, and a rational or objective system of ethics is possible, or else each individual's value judgments are ultimately arbitrary and solely a result of individual whim. Now, those are two words. There are two words there that I take issue with people often bring up to criticize the utilitarian position or the value-free social theory position. The words arbitrary and whim, because those words give the impression that when someone is making a value judgment, that they're somewhat indifferent to the two choices at hand, or to the path taken and the path renounced, or not even between the number one alternative and the number two alternative, but even between the number one alternative and lots of really low-ranked alternatives. Which is one of the reasons I think people often bring up the analogy of ice cream flavors, that, you know, you could take Rocky Road or you could take chocolate chip, but, you know, they're both chocolate flavored, so it doesn't really matter. It's those kinds of decisions and those kinds of value judgments that are often thought of when you hear the words arbitrary and whim, but those aren't, that's not usually the state of affairs that we're talking about when we're talking about value judgments concerning public policy and concerning politics and economic affairs. That usually those policies, that there's a very strong value judgment, and it is still a subjective value judgment. Subjective does not mean indifferent. It's still subjective. But in these affairs, usually they're not just, yeah, I could take it, I could leave it. You don't really care. Those are the kind of value judgments that you think of when you hear the words arbitrary and whim. But I reject the idea that subjectivity implies whims, because whims are about really matters where you're really indifferent. And most of the times when it comes to these questions, that people have a very strong desire for one alternative and a desire to avoid other alternatives. Okay, so that's one issue. I'm going to go now to the next quote. Rothbard says the following. I contend that it is the responsibility of any scientist, indeed any intellectual, to refrain from any value judgment whatever unless he can support it on the basis of a coherent and defensible ethical system. So through much of this paper, what Rothbard is doing is he's critiquing the attempts of value-free scientists to remain value-free while at the same time making policy recommendations of some sort. And he takes the somewhat strong claim that not only are there difficulties with that, but basically, unless you have some sort of objective theory of ethics, you should essentially remain silent about all policy recommendations. And this is one question that I'd like to ask Dr. Gordon, especially since he knew Rothbard personally. Do you think that Rothbard would have actually advised Ludwig von Mises himself to be silent concerning policy, concerning liberalism and the state and property rights and economic affairs and economic policies? Do you think that he would have actually advised Mises to have remained silent on these matters until he, Mises himself, formulated an objective system of ethics? Because I somewhat doubt that, because Mises was a hero of Rothbard's. Rothbard actually had a picture of Mises, and Walter Block tells a story of going into Rothbard's, I forgot whether it was his office or his home, and seeing a picture of Mises, and this was before Dr. Block had acquired an admiration for Mises himself, but this was after Walter Block had become an anarcho-capitalist, and Walter Block said to Rothbard, like, what are you doing with a picture of that statist on your wall? And I forgot what Walter Block said Rothbard's reaction was, but it was kind of kind of a smiling reaction. But so indeed, Mises was a hero of Rothbard. Rothbard dedicated Man, Economy, and State to Mises. So it's hard to imagine that Rothbard would follow through with this somewhat stringent injunction for all social theorists to remain silent concerning value judgments unless they can support it on the basis of an objective ethics. Since Mises himself, since that would have effectively silenced Mises himself. Okay, so there is that. Going on to my next highlighted quote. Rothbard then talks about another kind of way, one kind of way that economists try to get beyond what Rothbard considers a prima facie obstacle to stating policy judgments and being value-free at the same time. He talks about the comparison between an economist and a physician, a doctor who does not, who basically applies the findings of medical science in order to make judgments about means given the ends of his patient. So the patient presumably wants to live and not suffer. And so the doctor takes those ends as given and then from those ends judges the means of eating well, eating certain kinds of food, taking certain kinds of medicine, of adopting a certain exercise regimen. In the same way, the economist takes is sort of like a physician, and the general public is sort of like a patient, and the economist sort of takes it for granted that the general public prefers health to sickness, wealth to destitution, and security to danger, and based on that makes policy recommendations, which for the liberal economists would be tantamount to liberalism, would amount to liberalism. Now, Rothbard has a problem with this. He says that such an economist is still illegitimately going beyond the bounds of the economist per se. He says, nevertheless, the physician does make a value judgment, and even if a person is in society shares the same value and goal, the economist who goes along with such a value is still making a value judgment, even if, indeed, universally shared. He is still illegitimately going beyond the bounds of the economist per se, and his value judgments must still be supported by rational argument. Now, for one thing, it's important to note that while there is no such thing as a value-free action, and that is something that is completely completely goes along with Mises' theory of praxeology in general, is that every action is a choice. It's every action is choosing one thing and setting aside another. So every action does involve a value judgment. When you choose one thing and set aside another, that means you value one thing over the other. So there's no such thing as a value-free action. There is such a thing as a value-free science, but in choosing to adopt a value-free science, that is still an action, so that in itself is not value-free. So I don't think Mises would ever go so far with regard to value freedom to say that to be a true scientist, the scientist must embark in value-free action, because there's no such thing as value-free action. All actions imply some kind of a value. So it is true that if a scientist makes a recommendation that is an action, and so there are values that determine that action. And presumably, if an economist or a doctor were to want to help someone achieve their goals, then they probably are not vehemently against those goals themselves. So Rothbard brings up the example of a social scientist who is advising Nazis, maybe advising how to set up the most effective internment camps, and so he says that, well, if someone were advising such people that they're adopting their goals by advising them, by trying to help them, by trying to facilitate their achievement of those goals. And that is true. So a social scientist, in choosing to help any given client or any given advisee, is that there are certain value judgments that he's making by doing that, but that doesn't mean that there's something illegitimate about that. I don't think Mises would advise Nazis how. Obviously, someone who was on the run from Nazis, as Mises was, Mises fled. First, he had to flee his home in Austria, and then he ended up in Switzerland, and then he even had to flee Switzerland as well and go to America, all because of the Nazis. So he presumably wouldn't advise Nazis how to set up internment camps. So the Rothbard seems to think that the utilitarian will adopt the ends of anyone who asks them any question whatsoever, or will adopt the ends of the majority of any given population. And so Rothbard says, well, what if the majority of the population, like the Germans, when the Nazis were in power, the Germans wanted really illiberal things at the time. Some really ugly things that the German populace in general, not just the top level Nazis, but the German population in general, that they wanted. And of course, Mises wouldn't want to facilitate those things just because that the majority of that given subset of the population of the earth wanted it at the time. So that is not what utilitarians say. And so Rothbard raising that as some sort of an objection, I don't think is necessarily fair, because that's not what utilitarians are saying. Furthermore, there's the issue of rightly understood interests. So I'm going to go to the quote about that. Rothbard writes, "Now, this is surely an ingenious attempt to allow pronouncements of good or bad by the economist without making a value judgment. For the economist is supposed to only be a praxeologist, a technician, pointing out to his readers or listeners that they will all consider a policy, quote, bad once he reveals its full consequences. But ingenious as it is, the attempt completely fails. or how could Mises know what the advocates of the particular policy considered desirable? How could he know what their value scales are now and what they will be when the consequences of the measure appear? Now, this, I think, makes the mistake of thinking that people make judgments qua economists, that people, when they're talking about these sorts of affairs, only do so as an economist. But the economist is only one aspect of the person, Mises. Mises, as a liberal, is a composite. There's the economist aspect of him, but there's more to him. Particularly, there is the historian, or what in Misesian terms is the thymologist. Now, Mises can know what the advocates of a particular policy consider desirable, but not as an economist. He can know it as a historian, or as you might say, as a psychologist, not in the terms of empirical psychology, but in the terms of psychology that, as Mises defined it, as someone who uses his faculty of the specific understanding, which is a term Mises used for the insight that people have into the minds of others. You see, praxeology concerns action as such. It is just the formal logic of ends. It takes ends as given, and it doesn't try to get at what the ends actually are. It doesn't try to discern what the value judgments actually are, the concrete value judgments. But the historian, using thymology, or what might be called psychological insight, the historian can try to infer concrete value judgments. We do it all the time. And it's not an exact science in the way that praxeology and economics are exact sciences. Two historians might look at the same historical incident and make conflicting judgments about it. And those judgments aren't just based on the basis of whim, but there isn't some sort of 100% logical test that you can use to say, oh, this historian is right and this historian is wrong. But that doesn't mean that you can't glean insight into these affairs. And so Mises, when he's talking about liberalism, when he's talking about the conclusion that most people prefer health to sickness and wealth to destitution and security to danger, he's doing that as a historian using the psychological insight of a historian, using thymology. And so that is how Mises knows, that he's using his historical thymological judgment, which is very strong. Mises had great historical insight to make those conclusions about what most people want in terms of politics, in terms of the end that most people want. Now, Rothbard also talks about Mises's what Mises talks about liberalism and time. Because Mises often talked about the harmony of rightly understood interests. And Rothbard is correct in saying that what Mises meant by rightly understood interests was long-run interests. And Rothbard objected to that because he thought that that was slipping in a value judgment through the back door by assuming that a certain long run should be preferred to the short run. That it involves a critique of a certain time preference, that if you have a high enough time preference, a high enough preference for now as opposed to later, that that was objectively wrong somehow, but that this was kind of slipped in without any analysis. So the quote here, and certainly Mises, as a value-free scientist, could never presume to criticize anyone's rate of time preference to say that A's was too high and B's was too low. But in that case, what about the high time preference people in society who retort to the praxeologist, quote, perhaps this high tax and subsidy policy will lead to a decline of capital. Perhaps even the price control will lead to shortages, but I don't care. Having a high time preference, I value more highly the short-run subsidies or the short-run enjoyment of buying the current good at cheaper prices than the prospect of suffering the future consequences. Then Rothbard says, and Mises, as a value-free scientist and opponent of any concept of objective ethics, could not call them wrong. Now, the problem here is that Mises is not saying that any given rate of time preference is better than another rate of time preference. But the issue is, with rightly understood interests, with long-run interests, is that the long-run consequences of policy decisions are harder to see than the short-run consequences. It's not that people ignore them because they're distant. Even though they know about them, they just ignore them because they're distant, because they prefer the short run. The issue is that because they're distant, they don't know about them. It takes the science of economics to be able to discern what the long-run consequences are. And Mises is saying, using his psychological insight as a historian, that most people, if they knew both the short-run and the long-run consequences, that the long-run negative consequences of interventionist policies would turn them off from interventionist policies. That if they were able to consider both the long run and the short run together, that they would go for liberalism. Okay? It's not that people should choose the long run over the short run. It's that people don't know about the long run. So if they did know about the long run, then they would be able to make a more informed decision, taking both the long run and the short run into consideration. And that most people, with that knowledge, would choose liberalism. So I think that's a misinterpretation that Rothbard had of Mises's doctrine of the rightly understood interests. Next. So let me look at the chat, see what people are saying. Okay, so Dr. Gordon says Mises wouldn't condemn Mises to silence. Oh, I'm assuming he means Rothbard wouldn't condemn Mises to silence because Mises was arguing on the basis of an explicit ethical system. Rothbard doesn't say that only those with correct systems should speak. Note that even if the social scientist advisor must have a value judgment that the person's goal deserve to be fulfilled. It doesn't follow that the content of his advice incorporates any value judgments. That's true, any particular value judgments. I agree with that. Now, about the arguing on the basis of an explicit ethical system, I got the, maybe I'm wrong, but I got the impression that what Rothbard meant was not just that the discussion of the social theorist is informed by a systematic consideration of ethical matters. My impression was that for Rothbard, you had to have some sort of system of objective ethics, that you had to derive the is from the ought, that you couldn't deny objective ethics in the way that Mises did, and still make policy recommendations. That was the impression that I got from the book, but I could be wrong. So please feel free to correct me on that. Okay. So this is my Nook that I'm using. The one thing about the Nook, I'll say for those so people have asked me about the Nook. The one bug is that sometimes when you click for the next page, that it gets locked in on advancing pages, and so it starts zooming through the pages, and it'll zoom all the way to the end unless you stop it, and so that then you end up losing your place. So that's one bug that the Nook has. I don't know if the Kindle has that as well, but I prefer the Nook because it has native support for EPUBs, for the EPUB format, and that's really nice because Mises.org has a lot of great EPUBs, and so does the Online Library of Liberty. And EPUBs are nicer to read than PDFs because the pagination just flows. With a PDF, the justification and the pagination will be kind of like clumpy because, you know, it's paginated for physical paper for a certain amount of pages. And so to get the font size to the right size that you can read it on this kind of a screen, it's not going to be lined up with the pages of a physical book. With an EPUB, that doesn't matter because it's kind of like one big HTML document, and it just flows. So it doesn't matter what the size is. So Leslie says, are there any slides? Yes, I have slides up right now. I'm going to email them to Matt to post them. But they're mostly they're just title headings right now. They're not like full complete sentences this time around. So Charles is saying, Danny, are you saying that the main factor which frustrates the establishment of a liberal social order is widespread economic ignorance? Yes, and that's basically what Mises said as well. That the main contentions in society involve questions of means, of questions of what is the most effective way of ensuring widespread prosperity, and what is the most effective way of making for a peaceful and society where people are healthy and comfortable, and that is an issue of economic ignorance that. And so Mises' historical-phenomenological judgment is that if most people knew the long-term consequences of the policies of interventionist policies, that they wouldn't want that. So Rothbard objects to that by saying, Rothbard says, the great analyst of ranked value scales and diminishing marginal utility should have been more aware of such competing values and goals. He says that about Mises. For example, many people, whether through envy or a misplaced theory of justice, may prefer far more equality of income than will be attained on the free market. Many people may want less abundance in order to whittle down our allegedly excessive influence. Others, as I have mentioned, may prefer to loot the capital of the rich or the businessman in the short run, while acknowledging but dismissing the long-run ill effects because they have high time preference. Now, it is true that it's logic, it's conceivable that people could want that. So the Misesian case for liberalism doesn't say that it's praxeologically impossible for people to want that. But the point, but the historical and phenomenological conclusion of Mises is that people don't want that. Now, another telling passage is that a majority coalition of the foregoing might well opt for some reduction in wealth and prosperity on behalf of other values. And then it goes on later, what could Mises reply to a majority of the public who have indeed considered all the praxeological consequences and still prefer a modicum, or for that matter, even a drastic amount of statism in order to achieve some of their competing goals? But the point, the problem is, people have not considered all the praxeological consequences. Rothbard says, the majority of the public who have indeed considered all the praxeological consequences. But that is almost like you're saying that everybody knows Austrian economics and everybody knows the praxeological consequences of all these measures. But that's not the case. People don't know that. And so people are not making you might get the impression that, oh, well, people ultimately prefer all these kind of other goals like egalitarianism and really short-run goals as opposed to long-run goals, even though they know the wealth destruction and the long-run bad consequences of it. But that's not the case. People don't know those things because they don't know the praxeological consequences. They don't know Austrian economics. They don't know praxeology. And so if people did, all this lip service that people pay towards, you see, the whole thing about egalitarianism, ultimately that is about secular prosperity as well. That is about wealth as well. It just happens to be about the wealth of a particular class of people. So these people in the Occupy Wall Street movement, it's not like they have this pseudo ascetic goal of saying like, oh well, we know that capitalism would make us and our other 99% brethren poorer, but we love equality, so we'll take the poverty in exchange for the equality. That's not what they're saying. The reason why they want equality is because getting equality, they think, means going like this, it's not about going like this. They think it's about going like this. They think that achieving equality would involve an enrichment of the lower strata of society, the lower stratas of society that they are part of, or that they are advocating for. Okay, the equality means the lower levels getting pulled up to a higher level by pulling down the people at the top, the people in the 1%. Ultimately, it's not equality for equality's sake. Ultimately, it is about material enrichment. And sure, a lot of people that the you know sort of in the more theoretical people will you'll see some academics saying like, well, equality is an end in itself, and you know that they might even say, well, we'd rather have, even if it meant, you know, a certain degree of more poverty, even for the lower classes themselves, that we'd want that. But the driving force, what people really are, because you can find people in the academics, you can find academics saying anything. That doesn't mean that that's what's driving the vast majority of the population. What's driving the vast majority of the population is material interests when it comes to economic policy. And they only want equality because they think that by moving towards equality, they would be enriching themselves or the people that they're advocating for. So while it's true that it's conceivable that someone could want equality simply for equality's sake at the expense of enrichment, I think with my own psychological insight, my own historical judgment, and Mises's historical judgment, which I think is very sound, most people aren't primarily concerned about that. And if they really did know the praxeological consequences of what they're advocating, they wouldn't actually advocate it. Okay, so going on to my next slide. Rothbard's critique of Hume. Now, in Ethics of Liberty, Rothbard criticized Hume, and he took aim at Hume because Rothbard was really trying to rehabilitate objective ethics, trying to rehabilitate the idea of deriving the ought from the is. And he said that David Hume is the philosopher supposed by modern philosophers to have effectively demolished the theory of natural law. Hume's demolition was two-pronged, the raising of the alleged fact-value dichotomy, thus debarring the inference of value from fact, and his view that reason is and can only be a slave to passions. In short, in contrast to the natural law view that man's reason can discover the proper ends for man to follow, Hume held that only the emotions can ultimately set man's ends, and that reason's place is as the technician and handmaiden to the emotions. Here, Hume has been followed by modern social scientists since Max Weber, and of course, Max Weber was the one who really popularized the term, this is me talking, the term Bertfrey for value-free science, and that's what the doctrine that Mises followed. So Mises following Weber was also following Hume. Going on to the quote, Rothbard's quote, according to this view, people's emotions are assumed to be primary and an unanalyzable given. And this is analogous to the way that Mises said that ends are ultimately primary and unanalyzable givens. And Hume would say that these ends ultimately stem from the emotions. Let Rothbard goes on to cite a scholar named Hazelberg. Professor Hazelberg has shown, however, that Hume, in the course of his own discussions, was compelled to reintroduce a natural law conception into his social philosophy, and particularly into his theory of justice. For Hume, in Hazelberg's words, recognized and accepted that the social order is an indispensable prerequisite to man's well-being and happiness, and that this is a statement of fact. Close quote. The social order, therefore, must be maintained by man. Hazelberg continues, but a social order is not possible unless man is able to conceive what it is and what its advantages are, and also conceive those norms of conduct which are necessary to its establishment and preservation. Now, the problem here is that Hume isn't talking about ends. Rothbard makes it seem like Hazelberg has proven that Hume is resorting back to an objective analysis, an objective derivation of ends. But he's still talking about means. He's saying that the social order is a means for the ends that people want. So I don't see how this raises a problem for Hume. So Rothbard goes on, Hazelberg concludes that thus Hume's original primacy of the passions thesis is utterly untenable for his social and political theory, and he is compelled to reintroduce reason as a cognitive normative factor in human social relations. But Hume would just say that, okay, the human passions have made it such that people want certain things. They want, Mises would say, they want prosperity, they want health, they want security. And so then the reason of man is able to adjust means to those ends. You see, the passions are still primary. The passions are still what originate the ends. And the reason is adjusting means to those ends, and reason is able to ascertain that a certain social order is conducive to those ends. So yes, of course, reason is a factor in human relations. It is a factor in human action. Hume never said that it wasn't. It's just not the ultimate factor. In Hume's system, the passions, the ends, are still the ultimate factor, and the means are just adjusted for the sake of those ends. So I don't see where Rothbard is getting some kind of a contradiction here. In Hume's construction, the social order is a means to the end of human happiness. And as Rothbard himself states, Hume recognizes the value of natural law in choosing means, and natural law in the more expansive sense, in terms of like laws of cause and effect, not natural law in terms of like laws of objective morality, because Hume did not subscribe to that kind of natural law. And nowhere in his construction does Hume ever promote the use of natural law to choose the end of human happiness. It is only promoted for the means of social order. Okay, so that is my response to Rothbard's critique of Hume. There's an issue that I have with one particular passage in the Ethics of Liberty, and maybe Dr. Gordon could tell me if he agrees with this or not. This is one passage that is very kind of pseudo-Randian, I would say, because it's talking about the values implied by choosing life, that if you're living, that implies certain things. And it's also sort of proto-Hoppian, both Hoppe and Stephan Kinsella look at this passage as really key in Rothbard's ethics and as sort of foreshadowing Hoppe's own argumentation ethics. So Rothbard talks about, raises the possibility of the Crusoe on his island about to eat poisonous mushrooms, and someone warns him that they are poisonous. Rothbard says, if Crusoe had eaten the mushrooms without learning of their poison effects, then his decision would have been incorrect, a possibly tragic error based on the fact that man is scarcely automatically determined to make correct decisions at all times. Hence his lack of omniscience and his liability to error. If Crusoe, on the other hand, had known of the poison and eaten the mushrooms right away, perhaps for kicks or from a very high time preference, then his decision would have been objectively immoral, an act deliberately set against his life and health. So this is a very strong claim that Rothbard is making. This is not a matter of interpersonal conduct. So when Hoppe talks about ethics, he explicitly excludes Crusoe situations because he considers ethics to be distinctly about interpersonal affairs. Here, Rothbard is actually inserting morals into affairs of just one man, into just Crusoe economics, and saying that if he knew that these mushrooms are poisonous, that it would actually be immoral to eat them, even if he wanted to. It may well be asked, this is continuing the quote, it may well be asked why life should be an objective ultimate value, why man should opt for life in duration and quality. In reply, we may note that a proposition rises to the status of an axiom when he who denies it may be shown to be using it in the very course of the supposed refutation. So I'm sure you can see the how this jibes with argumentation ethics. Now, any person participating in any sort of discussion, including on one on values, is by virtue of so participating alive and affirming life. For if he were really opposed to life, he would have no business in such a discussion. Indeed, he would have no business continuing to be alive. Hence, the supposed opponent of life is really affirming it in the very process of his discussion. And hence, the preservation and furtherance of one's life takes on the stature of an incontestable axiom. Close quote. Now, I think Rothbard is committing a non sequitur here. I think he's ignoring the time structure of action, and he's sort of falling into the same fallacies that the classical economists fell into when they talked about abstract classes, valuing abstract classes. So when before Menger, Karl Menger, and before the modern economics arose in the 1870s, there was the water diamond paradox, and so the classical economists wondered why diamonds were valued more highly than water, even though water was more useful than diamonds. And the problem was that they were considering the two things as a class. They were considering water as a class versus diamonds as a class. And sort of implicitly, they were considering the entirety of the supply of water versus the entirety of the supply of diamonds. So they were kind of considering, well, what would you, if you could only have water or diamonds, only water or diamonds for the rest of your life, obviously you would want water because you would die without it, and you wouldn't want diamonds. So the problem was that they weren't realizing that people consider not classes of goods, that they consider concrete amounts of goods, given given the scarcity or abundance of the good. So diamonds, one diamond is valued more highly than 1 gallon of water, because you're not considering the whole class. You're considering, what would that additional diamond get me versus what would that additional gallon of water get me? And the thing is that when you already have a whole bunch of water that's available, that the more water that you have, the lower priority is the thing that you're allocating it to. So your first amount of water that you get, that's for bare survival, just for not dying of thirst. And maybe the second quantity of water you get is for staying clean. And the more water that you add to your supply, the lower you're going down in your value scale. And when you give up a certain amount of water, you're not going to give up the thing that's at the top of your value scale. You're going to give up the thing that is at the bottom. That's the thing that depends on that concrete quantity of water. So given a certain quantity of water that's available, you're probably like maybe only giving up slip and slide or squirt gun fights. And it's that use that you're comparing against the use that you would get from one diamond. And so that might be giving it to your wife or giving it to your mother, and the happiness that you would, you're comparing that happiness that you would get from that to the happiness of the squirt gun fight. And so once you think of that in concrete quantities, then it makes sense. And so Rothbard was also kind of thinking in terms of classes, that the person, he's saying that the person who ate the poisonous mushroom, that he be, by doing that, be against life, but he's thinking about eating mushrooms, so he's living, so he's for life at the same time, so that's somehow a conflict. But it's not a conflict. If someone was considering eating the poisonous mushroom and possibly killing himself, he has chosen to, that means that he had not chosen to kill himself the moment prior. He's choosing to live at that moment, but he's valuing life in like particular units of life. He's saying if he makes a decision to eat the poisonous mushroom and die, he's saying I value life right now as I'm considering this, because I'd like to consider this. And then if he ultimately makes the decision to eat the poisonous mushroom, he's saying, I would rather not be alive in the next, 10 minutes from now. Those are two different questions. So people aren't against life or for life as this abstract class, or they're making concrete decisions about certain consequences, certain living, being alive at certain times. So there isn't the conflict that Rothbard seems to think there is, and so I for that, this one in particular, I'd really love to know what Dr. Gordon thinks. If Dr. Gordon also thinks that Rothbard made a logical error in this passage. Now on to Hans Hermann Hoppe. There's a few issues that I have with his argumentation ethics that I'd like to raise. One of the ways that he approaches discovering a rational ethic is that he has a standard that the ethic needs to be equally applicable to everyone or universally acceptable by everyone. And I think that's one way of sort of defining your way into a victory by making these standards and saying that, well, anything that deviates from these standards by definition is not an ethic. So Stefan Molyneux also takes this approach and so he kind of defines away all these alternative ethics by saying, well, they don't fit this criterion. But the thing is that when people consider ethics, whether or not you think that it's fitting this criterion, they won't necessarily care about that. In practice, people do favor codes of interpersonal conduct, and they themselves call it ethics. Whether we define it as an ethic or not is one thing, but people do consider this as an alternative ethic for various systems in which there are privileges, where in which there are sort of people who are in a privileged state versus other people, and where there isn't equal applicability. And people think that, a lot of people think that having these kinds of arrangements is better for both, better for better for the people who are privileged, and better for the underprivileged people too, that the system works better for whatever reason, but they think that. And you can try to win the argument by just saying, well, that's not an ethic by according to this definition, but that's not really necessarily going to convince anyone. So if people want that, they're going to go for it anyway. So just by saying that, you know, it doesn't fit this criteria, it doesn't necessarily get you somewhere. So I don't see why the equally applicable standard is sort of just inserted as something that's obviously a necessary criterion for ethical norms. Now, another argument that Hoppe makes, he says, if all goods were co-owned by everyone, then no one, at no time and no place, would be allowed to do anything unless he had previously secured every other co-owner's consent to do so. So he does this in the part where he's trying to eliminate alternative ethics. So he's saying that, okay, first of all, it has to be equally applicable. And so let's consider these various equally applicable systems. So he has the liberal system, or the libertarian system, where everything is equally applicable, where people own that which they've homesteaded, contracted for, or produced. And then he has the system where everyone's co-owned by everyone. All goods are co-owned by everyone. And that does fit the equal applicability criterion. But he says it's not practical, because no one at no time and no place would be allowed to do anything unless he had previously secured every other co-owner's consent to do so. And then he says, in order to do that, it would take forever to actually say, okay, is it okay with you? Is it okay with you? Is it okay with you to do that? And then everyone would have starved by the time you get anything done. And also, in order to do that, he says that it would be logically impossible, because you have to, in order to ask someone for consent, you have to use your vocal cords, but in order to use your vocal cords, you have to have that consent to begin with, so you're kind of caught in a trap there. That's his way of like, okay, well, that's saying that is an equally applicable system, but it just doesn't work. And so he's trying to eliminate everything except for the libertarian system. Now, the problem with that is that he's confusing hands-on actual control and manipulation of goods with ultimate disposal of goods. You can have the ultimate disposal of goods without being in complete control of it all the time. And you can have a system where people, where you say, okay, well, in general, people can, you know, manipulate things because there's a general consent that's assumed unless the collective, you know, asserts its will. And so you can have the ultimate disposal of something being given to everyone equally, and so that you have that if there is a plebiscite and people say, okay, well, this thing that you've done with this resource, you can't do that anymore. That doesn't mean that people, you have to have, to be able to use resources, you have to have continual plebiscites all the time. So an example of this is that, you know, shareholders in a company ultimately have ultimate disposal over all the resources in the company. They are the owners of the company. That doesn't mean that the workers in the company who don't actually own the goods that they're working with, it doesn't mean that they can't, you know, work with them and on a day-to-day basis do stuff with them. That doesn't, the fact that they can do that doesn't mean that the shareholders don't actually own the thing. They do have ultimate disposal over the thing. It's just it doesn't mean that they have to be exercising their ultimate disposal in an active, hands-on manner all the time, continually, for things to get done. So so I think that's one thing that Hoppe doesn't, a distinction that Hoppe doesn't make. So another argument that Hoppe makes, he says, argumentation between Crusoe and Friday requires that both have and mutually recognize each other as having exclusive control over their respective bodies, their brain, vocal cords, etc. And Dr. Gordon, I think, has made a really good critique of this position. Dr. Gordon has said that just because you are not physically stopping someone from using something doesn't mean that you are thinking that they are rightful owners of the thing. And an important distinction that I think that Hoppe doesn't make is the one made by Mises in his book Socialism. In his book Socialism, Mises talks about the juridical concept of ownership versus the economic concept of ownership. There's two definitions of ownership. For the economic concept of ownership is who is actually controlling something, the actual control. The juridical concept is who should control and who is the rightful controller. And and so just because you so Crusoe and Friday, they need to have economic control or actual control of their respective bodies in order for them to argue with each other. But that doesn't mean that, but the fact economic control does not imply, economic ownership does not necessarily imply juridical ownership. So that doesn't make any kind of, it doesn't mean that, that they consider each other rightful owners. There could be any number of factors that goes into the fact that Crusoe and Friday are, in actuality, not stopping each other from using their brains and vocal cords. So the example that I give is that I imagine, you know, like in Aesop's fables, you have, you know, animals talking with each other, and so I imagine a fable in which a lion and an antelope are discussing ownership and rights, and the antelope is a Hoppian, and the antelope believes in argumentation ethics, and the antelope says, you see, lion, by the fact that you're even arguing with me, you recognize that I own my body, that I own my antelope body. But the lion, maybe he's just not hungry at the moment. Or maybe he's just exhausted from eating other antelopes all day. Or maybe this particular antelope doesn't look appetizing. There's any number of reasons why a lion might, and of course we're considering it a rational lion. If you consider the animals as being these particular animals as being rational beings, you kind of consider them as analogous to humans right now. There are all sorts of reasons that the lion might have for not consuming the antelope that don't necessarily have anything to do with the lion considering the antelope as being a rightful owner of its own body. So I don't think that argument holds water. Another thing that Hoppe says that I don't agree with, he tries to say that the property rights norms are not a convention, because he says that if there a convention is something for which there are alternatives, that you can have a convention of doing one thing, but there are alternative conventions that you could have. And he says that there's no alternative to a property rights norm, private property rights norm, because all other alternatives are conflict generating. And conflict generating norms contradict the very purpose of norms. Therefore, they're not norms, he says. So the only real norm is a private property norm. And I don't think that follows either, because by the same token, you could say that that sickness-generating medicine contradicts the very purpose of medicine. So by that token, you would say that any medicine that has any kind of side effect isn't really a medicine, just for the fact that it has side effects. That doesn't make any sense. It's medicine with side effects. You still call it medicine. And in the same way, if there are norms that do generate conflict in some cases, as long as they avoid conflict in some cases, even if it was just one case where they avoided conflict. And as long as that's the purpose for which the norm is being adopted, then it's still a norm. It's the purpose, and mostly it's the purpose for which a thing is adopted that determines what you call it. So that would be my objection to that. So those are my thoughts about Rothbard's and Hoppe's discussion, both of Mises' ethics and of their own ethics. And I've gone a bit over, and I apologize for that, but I just wanted to, there's a lot of issues that I kept not having time to cover in previous lectures, and so since this is the last lecture, I wanted to get it all out there. And also, I hope you give me a certain leeway of going at length on this stuff, especially since Mises doesn't have that many defenders these days. That for the most part, libertarians are all, at least Austro-libertarians, are either Rothbardians or Hoppians, that they subscribe to natural law ethics or argumentation ethics, and for the most part, at least the more prominent writers don't defend Mises' utilitarianism. So I hope you understand if I go try to fill in the gap a little bit in that way. So reading what people have posted, Charles says, even if they can see the superiority of capitalism in terms of economic efficiency, they might view substituting egalitarianism for capitalism as desirable if they view capitalism as exploitative. Their motivation then would not be maximizing human welfare, but minimizing dissatisfaction would not be maximizing satisfaction. And again, I'm not saying, and Mises is not saying, that it's inconceivable that someone could prefer egalitarianism to economic efficiency and to human happiness, human welfare, but it's just not actual. That it's that's not the way people have been and people are today. Their motivation, you say their motivation would not be maximizing human welfare, but minimizing satisfaction. It seems like you're saying the same thing, but in a positive, stated positively, but the same thing stated negatively in the next phrase. So I'm not sure how those two things are different, maximizing human welfare versus minimizing satisfaction. So maybe you, the choice is not always, maybe you clarify it here in your recent post. The choice is not always available to maximize satisfaction. Sometimes we must choose between dissatisfactory state. No, that would still be maximizing satisfaction. I mean, every state is satisfactory to a certain extent and dissatisfactory to a certain extent. As long as it's not perfect, and as long as there's room for improvement, and as long as there's are alternatives that you can conceive of that are worse. So maximizing satisfaction doesn't mean that you're achieving perfection. It just means that you're moving up in your value scales in some way, even if it's just a tiny move in your value scale. And so maximizing satisfaction is just, maximizing is kind of a tricky word, because then it gets at sort of quantitative ways of thinking about things that aren't, I like the word optimizing better, optimizing satisfaction, that you're just trying to achieve what is most preferable. And so I would state it that way, then I think it's obviously false to say the choice is not always available to go for what is most preferable. Because every time we act, we are trying to go for what we consider as most preferable. So if you call maximizing satisfaction going for what's most preferable, then I think your statement is false, because we do that all the time. We're always trying to maximize satisfaction by definition. We're always trying to go for what is most preferable. Leslie Webb says, on economic ignorance and liberalism, I think in, quote, in the clash of group interests, Mises writes that in a democracy, groups with short-term interests are able to capture the powers of the state and have it act in their interest. Yet indoctrination of the general populace would also seem to be one of the ends of these short-term interest groups. If democracy tips the scales in favor of short-term interest groups attaining their material interests in public opinion, will it not also tip the scales in favor of these groups gaining power to indoctrinate the general populace with economic ignorance? If so, this would seem to be an argument from necessity and assumption against a democratic minimal state. Yes, and this is another particular area where I myself differ from Mises as well. Not only am I an anarcho-capitalist, but I actually follow Hoppe in his critique of democracy. And Hoppe's critique of democracy, I think you'll find if you read Democracy, the God That Failed, is not dependent on his argumentation ethics doctrine. And I think the arguments he makes against democracy are very sound. And I think Mises was not only incorrect in advocating for a state, but in particular, between competing states, I think he was incorrect in thinking that democracies had particular advantages. Mises argued that democracies are better. It actually does follow from his social theory in general. In the first lecture, I talked about the power of ideas and how Mises said that the majority ideology is always the ideology that is always what determines social order, any given social order. And so since that is always the case, he preferred a democracy over other systems because a democracy, he says, has the means, has in a democracy, you can have those changes in majority ideology be reflected in shifts in public policy through peaceful means, that you can just have new elections. And that way that any shift in the majority ideology can be reflected through the outcome of those elections instead of having a shift in the majority ideology determine the support for a rival monarch or rival group of oligarchs, but then they have to achieve power through violent means, through some kind of a civil war, a revolution. So that's his argument for democracy. But there are so many problems with democracy that Hoppe raises, and I think that it's really clear that democracies are actually, I believe, inferior to monarchies, and that just in the same way that private ownership of the means of production are better than public ownership of the means of production. Private ownership of the means of predation, you might say, are better than public ownership of the means of predation. The Hoppe makes the point that when there's private ownership of the state, that at least then there's some sort of rationality there, that the owner of the state has a certain interest in maximizing the economic prosperity of the subjects in order to increase his income. Whereas in a democracy, there isn't anything like that. And basically, what you said in your post, Leslie, happens, that that you get a whole bunch of short-term interest groups just fighting each other. And I could go on about democracy, but since this isn't a class about democracy, I think it would be better if we, hopefully, if we at some point could have a course on Democracy, the God That Failed. I think that would be great. I know even though Stephen Kinsella is really a strong Hoppean, he's not all that interested in Hoppe's democracy discussion. So I don't know, maybe Dr. Gordon would like to teach a course on that book. One thing is that book isn't available for free online, so people would have to buy it, but I would definitely love to take that class. So basically I agree with you on your critique, Leslie, of Mises's support for democracy. Charles Devon says, Hazlitt talks about this giving the example of a martyr. The choice is not always available. Oh. Hazlitt talks about this giving the example of a martyr. Oh, okay. So Charles says, never mind about the martyr thing. Okay. That's fine. Well, if anyone has any more questions, please post them in the either in the chat. Chat is probably fine because usually I have people post in the Q&A because the screen of the Q&A freezes no matter what people enter. But that doesn't become an issue if the chats are coming in kind of slow. So feel free to just post in the chat box, and I'll be able to read that just fine. Also, Dr. Gordon, since this is the last lecture, if there was anything that you wanted to say, I could pass you a mic if you wanted to say if there are any last thoughts about that you wanted to say audibly instead of typing it out, any responses to anything that I've said, or any further thoughts about the topics that you wanted to say, let me know, and I can pass you a mic. We can both have microphones at the same time. Particularly, if anything has anything to say, any defenses of Hoppe, that'd be great to hear. See if my critiques that I raised in this last slide, if anyone has any issues. Oh, okay. So Dr. Gordon says, all right. So I will pass you a microphone.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Good. Well, basically, I thought you raised some excellent points. I thought one point to note, I put this in one of the chat comments, but there was a problem in Rothbard's paragraph where he says that if he says, well, suppose you're discussing values with other people, then aren't you affirming life as an objective value? Because you can't be opposing life as long as you're discussing. But see, the problem there, as I see it, if you're discussing with other people, say you don't, suppose you don't think life is an objective value because you don't believe in objective values. It doesn't follow that you're opposed to life. It's just you don't think there are any objective values. So I think that's a problem with that particular argument. So I thought you made, in my opinion, a very strong defense of Mises. And I was particularly glad in the course of your presentation that you didn't attack anything I said in the last lecture. That's always a good point. I think it is also a very good point you raised that Mises does think, I think he has good reason to think this, that in fact most people do want to have a prosperous life. But usually say when you look at the Nazis, they didn't come in and say to people, look, if we come in, you know, things are going to be much more difficult for you. You should vote for us because then you'll be able to sacrifice your life for the fatherland. I mean, they sometimes said that when people were fighting. They said, you know, if you elect us, we'll bring back German prosperity, we'll get all these lost territories, and we'll all be better off. I think people, the communists, did the same thing. I mean, they were saying, look, we have a proletarian revolution, we'll have all this great socialist system. So they really were saying, if you support us, we'll promote prosperity. I think that's a very good point Mises raises.
Yes, I agree. And I do think that with any movement, you're always going to have what you might call metaphysical window dressing. Mm-hmm. So at the top level of pro-Nazi theorists, I'm sure there were lots of theorists who would come up with elaborate arguments concerning like the nature of reality, mm-hmm. and that support their mm-hmm. policies, and so you'll always have theorists who make these kinds of propositions, but I believe that that's never the driving force of any movement. That's always sort of a theoretical window dressing that sort of gives a veneer of esoteric, this mumbo jumbo that kind of gives a veneer of intellectual respectability, but isn't what is really driving the man on the street or the man in the Nazi rally. They're, you know, the person in the Nazi rally wasn't ruminating in his mind over the esoteric arguments of Nietzsche or any of the other people who may have inspired certain arguments that ultimately was about material welfare.
There's an interesting point. You know, probably the most important philosophical defense of the National Socialism was Alfred Rosenberg's book, Myth of the 20th Century. So someone once asked Hitler, what do you think of Rosenberg's book? He said, I never read it.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's highly telling. In the same way, I think that a lot of the more esoteric arguments for egalitarianism is also sort of window dressing. Because some theorists will go so far as to say, well, even if it makes people poor on all strata, that it would be better to have egalitarianism, especially if they sort of resort to envy mongering. I went to a lecture with in Berkeley. Robert Reich was giving a lecture, and this was before he actually joined the faculty of Berkeley. Now he's teaching at the School of Public Policy there. And for those of you who don't know Robert Reich, he's kind of a left progressive writer especially on economics. I think he was Labor Secretary under Clinton, and he raised the question. He asked, "What if there was a genie who could change everything so that everyone's absolute wealth was higher, but there was more inequality?" And would you accept that genie's proposal? And of course, this being in Berkeley, most people said that they wouldn't. Most people didn't raise their hand. Or he stated the opposite. Would you reject the proposal? And almost everyone raised their hand. And so, at that sort of like Berkeley level of theory, you'll get people who say those kinds of things, but for one thing, that's not what's motivating most people, I believe. And also, I don't think if push came to shove that they would really advocate it, because the issue that I raised in the question and answer period, I asked him, in a world where everything is economically interconnected, in a world like in this sort of economic network that we have, every big change in economic efficiency and productivity in one sector has an effect in other sectors, and so if you you can have this wealth destroying policy in one sector, and it'll affect other, it'll make for fewer opportunities across the board, really. Now, in terms of people like in the third world, for example, there are always people who are at the brink of starvation, where a little bit more absolute wealth would mean that they don't die of malnutrition, or their children don't die of malnutrition, and a little bit less level of an absolute wealth than they do die. So in that kind of system, you have to think about the fact that that this sort of indulgence that you're giving yourself in terms of reducing envy, because really that's what it amounts to, is envy monitoring. It's just like, oh, well, if you accepted the genie's proposition, there would be more envy in the world, and so people would, be less happy in that way. Well, when you think about the trade-off, and you think about the fact that reducing every big step that you take in reducing absolute wealth, regardless of relative levels of wealth, but reducing absolute wealth actually condemns large portions of people to starvation, especially people, these people in Berkeley who say that they, really want to help the people in the third world and the most underprivileged, underclass people in society. I don't think when push came to shove that they would be willing to just throw those people under the bus for the sake of reducing aggregate envy. So that's just a little anecdote that I wanted to tell.
Yeah, yes, I think also usually when you find people say, well, they'd be willing to sacrifice prosperity for equality, say certain egalitarian professors, they're usually pretty well off themselves, so they don't have much to worry about. I don't think there are any people who are really terribly badly off who say we don't care about material things so much, we just want to be equal.
That's right, what do you think of Mises' book, The Anti-Capitalist Mentality? Do you agree with Mises' basic conclusions of that book about what motivates anti-capitalism among intellectuals?
Oh, yes, I think that's a very good book. Yeah, that came out around 57 or so. See, what he was saying was that he drew a contrast between intellectuals in America and those in Europe. He said in Europe, and the intellectuals are in the high society, but they're not in America, and they're very resentful over that. I think that was a very perceptive observation. I think basically it's a good book, except the only thing I don't agree with in the book, he's very critical of detective stories. I rather like mystery stories, but he thinks that mystery stories are kind of a reflection of sort of anti-capitalist views in some way. Well, not all of them. He doesn't like mystery stories too much. But I think it's an underrated book. And when it came out, Whitaker Chambers, who was a famous ex-communist, the one with the pumpkin papers, was very critical of that, his correspondence with Bill Buckley. But I thought he was very, partially critical. And I think that's an underrated book. You know, there's other good stuff, like Nozick has a very good essay, Why Do Intellectuals Oppose Capitalism? It's sort of along the similar lines, and of course there's Hayek's great essay, The Intellectuals and Socialism. I mean, there are all sorts of good essays on why intellectuals oppose capitalism. I'm glad you mentioned that one.
Yeah, I remember that part of that book too, and I haven't read, obviously I haven't read the same detective stories that Mises has necessarily,
And he cited G.D.H. Cole, I think, who was a famous socialist who wrote detective stories also. So maybe he had particular ones in mind. But you're never pro-capitalist detective story writers.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there were. But I thought it was, there was sort of a modern parallel, or a modern way in which Mises' allegation was true after the fact. I've seen quite a few episodes of of the CSI, Crime Scene Investigation.
Oh, yeah.
It's a TV show. And so that's kind of like the most popular version of detective shows that we have, detective stories that we have now are these TV shows with following these crime scene investigators. And I really have noticed a huge, like almost exactly what Mises was talking about in terms of the old detective novels. I saw it almost perfectly in
Businessman is always the villain.
Yes, exactly. You would think that the business community is populated by sociopaths. Just everywhere you turn, there's a businessman murdering someone. And I remember in Thomas DiLorenzo's book on How Capitalism Saved America, he cites a study where they show the percentages in TV shows of different sectors of a population and who commits homicides in each sector, and for the in the TV shows, the murder, that it was way skewed towards the business community, that business people were doing the vast majority of the murders, and in real life it's just this tiny minority, and so it's just very skewed from real life. But also Mises talked about when he talked about detective stories, he talked about sort of the self-righteous judgment of the detective himself as he sort of uncovers the real underbelly of the business life and the kind of sordid things, not just the crimes themselves, but just sort of the sordid things that they were involved with all the time. And you see this like sort of righteous superiority on the part of the detective himself as he uncovers this underworld that lies beneath.
Yes, I think that's a good point. That means the same. When these people are appealing to a mass audience, that they're giving the audience the feeling that they're superior to the business people because they can really judge them. They're sort of by reading the novel, that they're feeling as if they're judging these characters who really have a lot more money than they do, so they can kind of work out their feelings of envy and resentment. Sort of. I thought that was a very perceptive psychological point, I thought. It's too bad in the book he didn't comment on the most important cultural development of the time he was writing, namely professional wrestling. I'm afraid he would have been critical. Somehow I get the feeling he would have been critical. Of course, he shouldn't have. I do get that feeling somehow.
I would love to read Mises' critique of professional wrestling. That would be great. But I totally see exactly what Mises was talking about reflected in these CSI shows. It's constantly these CSI detectives just uncovering like the sordid real life of these people in the business community and like the weird kinky sexual things that they're into and their willingness to just to murder in order to gain just the slightest business advantage. And it's always the profit motive that motivates these killers in these shows. And it's just so skewed from real life, because in real life, there's such a high opportunity cost of engaging in that kind of behavior. It's so dangerous that for the most part, people want to, business people, they want to just, you know, in order to make a profit on an ongoing basis, you have to avoid killing people. I mean, just the opportunity cost of murdering someone is so high in terms of just of your long-run prosperity as a businessman that it just makes sense that the murder rate would be kind of low for them. And in actuality, as DiLorenzo's statistics shows that he cited, that's the actual case, too. Matt says, I would love to see a Mises versus Gordon debate on that.
I'd win because Mises is dead. He wouldn't be able to answer.
He's affirming life. You can't judge his value judgments about poisonous mushrooms anymore. But Leslie says,
I'm not sure that's a good point. I might, I should be, but when you mentioned poison mushrooms, I must tell you one of my awful stories. There was a man who met a friend of his he hadn't seen for a long time, and the other man was crying, so he said, what's wrong? And the man said, oh, I just buried my third wife. Said, your third wife, what happened? He said, she died from eating poison. He said, I just buried my third wife. He said, well, your third wife, what happened to your first wife? He said, my first wife died from eating poison mushroom. And he said, well, what about your second wife? He said, she also died from eating poison mushrooms. So he said, well, I suppose you're going to tell me your third wife died from eating poison mushroom. He said, no, fractured skull. She wouldn't eat the poison mushroom.
That's a good one. Leslie Webb says, but many detective stories are also critical of the police and City Hall corruption. Raymond Chandler novels, for example. Modern TV shows, on the other hand, seem to glorify the police. Yes, that's a great point, Leslie. And, of course, the greatest detective stories of them all, the Sherlock Holmes story, you have somewhat a private investigator, someone who works for clients on a private basis, consistently embarrassing Scotland Yard, the government investigators, with his superior skills and his superior accomplishments. So that's another example of a non-anti-capitalist detective story that needs us to ignore. And I agree, Leslie, notable exception of The Wire, of course, says Matt. And yeah, I haven't seen The Wire. I want to, because that's consistently rated by a lot of people as one of the best written TV shows today or in contemporary time. Well, we've gone almost 2 hours now. People have, for the most part, stuck around. There was 13 participants a half hour ago, and there's 12, so hopefully people are enjoying our conversation. So feel free, if you have any more questions, to round off the last 6 minutes of the 2 hours. We could go a full 2 hours if you'd like. Matt says the fourth season is the best season of any television show I've ever seen ever. Ooh, that's a good endorsement. Yeah, I'll definitely have to either get it online. I don't know. Does Hulu have it? Do you know, Matt? I don't have it. I'm sure that it's good on DVD. Oh, so it's on HBO, so it wouldn't be on Hulu. Ralph Rako has a great lecture in his lecture series on History, the Struggle for Liberty, I think it's called, that he did at the Mises Institute. He goes over all the different theories that various classic liberal scholars have put forth for the anti-capitalist mentality. And I remember he was really critical of Hayek's explanation. And he was more favorable to Mises' explanation. Although he said that anti-capitalist mentality wasn't the best of his books, and he said that Mises makes a stronger explanation for the anti-capitalist mentality elsewhere. So that would be a good lecture, the lecture series to look up. It's on the Mises website. Ralph Rako, the History, the Struggle for Liberty. And it's in one of those middle lectures where he talks about the anti-capitalist mentality. Ross says, thanks, Danny and David. A great format. Danny would also like to add that you are one of my favorite authors. See you next time. Oh, thank you, Ross. That's very sweet of you to say. Charles says, Danny, do you think that classical liberal class theory is at all anti-harmonistic? Well, Rothbard does say that to an extent that he is a class conflict theorist, that he believes in class conflict. But, of course, the classes that he talks about are not the Marxist classes of the bourgeois versus the proletariat, that it's the state versus the rest of us, or more particularly the state and the state and state connected or the dependence of the state versus anyone else. I'm sorry, David, did you say something?
No, I just was talking.
And so in that way he does see sort of a anti-harmony, and Mises also sees that anti-harmony given state privileges. He says that it does create conflicts of interest. However, he says that within the market there's a harmony of interests. Within a free market there's a harmony of interests. However, I think there's a broader harmony of interests in that there is an interest in almost everybody, including a lot of people who are gaining short-term advantages from the state at the moment, to establish the free market in the first place. I think there's a broader harmony of interest there. So in a way, there is a even more robust harmonist position that you can get to by considering that fact that for the most part, even people who at the moment benefit from certain subsidies and certain other ways that they've succeeded in rent seeking, that they would benefit even more if we had a free market. And so in that way, there's an even broader harmony of interest that always persists, even when there isn't currently a free market. You're welcome, Justin. Thank you. Oh, that's nice of you to say, Luis. Thank you. And I want to thank Dr. Gordon so much for teaching this course of me. It's been a huge honor. I mean, Dr. Gordon is is just at the top of libertarian theory. I mean, he's just the smartest, like Doug French always says, he's the smartest guy in any room. And when Murray Rothbard first met him, he said some he said something to the effect that, oh, I just met a universal genius. And so, Dr. Gordon, you definitely are my hero in just the...
Well, thanks, Danny. I learned a lot. You gave an extremely effective defense of Mises, and I learned a lot. You clarified a number of points. You did a great job. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. And Robert says, even if he's not in the room, that's a great logical distinction. And Matt says, great class, guys. Also, Dr. Gordon, I'd like to add that as a fan of Bloodsport, I'm a fan of your critique. And Charles asks, what is the next class? And Dr. Gordon, I believe you were considering offering your logic class again.
That's right. I think I'd like to do that. Right.
Yeah, that'd be great. He taught Introduction to Logic course about a year ago. So probably in the winter, he'll be teaching that again. Robert, yes, lectures are still available to review. They'll continue to be available even after the course is over, and even after the and I'm going to post one last quiz. And I don't know, Dr. Gordon, in addition to Do you think just having a last quiz on the last week's topics is good enough, or do you think we should do a final?
I think one quiz is enough because we've given a lot, so I think that would cover, because we covered all the topics throughout.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah. And Robert asks for how long. I don't want to promise that it'll be up forever.
At least for 20 years.
Yeah, because websites become obsolete, and who knows, at some point Moodle might become obsolete and it won't be supportable. But we don't have any plans on taking it down. So as long as you have your password for it'll be up for a long time. And for myself, I was thinking of teaching a class. I've written a series of articles explaining Mises' principles of sort of crucial praxeology. So praxeology, particularly the principles that can be applied to a single isolated actor. So when you're talking about an isolated actor, you get into just the basic categories of action, all the first implications of the concept of action, plus you get into the concept of marginal utility, which I discussed somewhat in this lecture, and uncertainty, case probability versus class probability. There's a lot of really good stuff that you can get into of Mises' theory, even just on the isolated individual level. And so I wrote a series of articles based on that. And so I thought maybe I might teach a course on that too.
So you want to have a class on class probability.
Right. And then you could sue me, and then it'll be a case on case probability. David, not exactly this course, but which president never killed anyone?
Which president ever killed anybody? Let me see. Which president? I think Andrew Jackson killed somebody in the duel.
Yeah. He also, Andrew Jackson also had someone executed.
Oh, which president?
For desertion.
Yeah, that's right. It was somebody in Florida. There were probably, of course, there were presidents who were Civil War generals. I don't know if they directly killed them. Do you know which Supreme Court justice killed somebody?
Oh, I don't.
It was Stephen Field. Stephen J. Field. He shot somebody in a railroad car.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting factoid. So Robert says he means...
Oh, yeah, I guess a president who wasn't... If somebody says he wants to see a course, we teach a course on Rawls and Coase. Well, I don't know. We have to minimize transaction costs on that one.
Yeah, Dr. Gordon Rawls in his course on libertarianism and modern philosophy also.
Yeah, I had something on Rawls. Well, I guess I better be going, everybody, so thanks very much.
Okay, and I'm going to log off too. Thank you, everybody, and thank you, Dr. Gordon. And yeah, feel free to continue to post something in the discussion forum. Maybe we could have one last round of discussion about some of these issues on the website, on the course website. Yeah, I will post that quiz, and we will post the recording of this lecture as soon as it's available. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.